Ever try to get into one of Advertising Week's amazing sessions and suddenly hear that the room is at capacity? Now you can still experience it in real time. Listen to that keynote or panel as a live audio stream in the Advertising Week app, powered by Live365. Advertising Week Radio features sessions, podcast clips, curated music, and more, both during the shows and year-round. Visit aw.live365.com for easy access instructions. Live365, the world's audio.
Welcome to Great Minds as we wind down season 5, and this is an extraordinary treat. It's not often that you can say that you are about to talk to the longest continuously serving chief executive officer in business in America. That's not something, Dan, that we get to say every day. But in speaking with Dan Amos, the chairman and CEO of Aflac, that's exactly who we are talking to. So, Dan, I couldn't be more thrilled to have you. I'm a huge fan of the company, have charted your growth over the years. Your story is an incredible one. Special thanks to my pal Dan Beeson for putting us together. We love working with Dan. And to you, Dan Amos, a most heartfelt welcome here to Great Minds.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. Time does slip away quickly. It's hard to believe this is going on my 35th year with the company as a CEO.
An incredible, incredible story. And Dan, we got a lot of ground to cover. But I noticed something that you and I share, which is schooling in the great state of Georgia. I also went to Emory. I know you went there. I know you also went to UGA. And I'd love to go back and talk about University of Georgia. I did not go there, but we used to go there for football. It was back when Herschel Walker was a player. And I remember seeing Steve Young, quarterback for Brigham Young. So this was a long time ago. But I'd love to talk about the University of Georgia in Athens, such an interesting, creative hotbed, and how those early days in Athens and University of Georgia, the Bulldogs, how that helped shape you.
Well, it certainly, the University of Georgia had a big impact on my life. I was an only child, getting away and moving from Columbus, Georgia up to Athens, and really not knowing that many people at the time, because I had lived in Florida until I was 14. And getting up there, it was a wonderful, wonderful place to go. I always tell people, go into a state university. If you're going to stay in that state and work, not only the education you get, but also the networking that you build is of enormous value to you. And it has always worked out for me. My wife actually went to Emory and then went to Georgia Law School. And I had the pleasure of going to Georgia and majoring in risk management and insurance. And it was rated very high. In fact, I think it was the number one school for risk management and insurance in the U.S. And I learned a whole lot, but I learned things that are more than just the classroom about life. And I was involved with school politics and was president of the senior class. And you just kind of learn as you go along. And some of my best friends are friends that I met when I was a freshman at the university.
Yeah. And Dan, reflecting on my time in Georgia, I had a lot of friends from the South. And you can tell from my accent, what part of the world I'm from, that Brooklyn, Queens accent is hard to lose. And I was always struck by how well all of us, even though we were from such diverse backgrounds, got along. And Emory was a fraternity school. I know you were a Sigma Nu. My history of our fraternity was a racist history, that there had never been a black member in our chapter in Atlanta until my class. We were able to change that, but not without some considerable difficulty. Talk about what you saw then in Georgia. And I'm going to guess you also had a lot of friends from a lot of different places, and everybody figured out a way to get along and accept people's differences. We've gotten really far away from that in America. Talk about that and you know, sort of frame it with how you've managed Aflac over 35 some odd years.
Well, thank goodness we have changed. And to me, diversity is an important element of life. And from there, you can take it to school and then you can take it to business. But what a boring life we'd live if all we knew were 60, 70-year-old white guys. So it's nice to be able to have diversity from a women's perspective, from people of color, from all aspects. And I remember my senior year in high school, one of our senior superlatives was an African-American guy. And so my class kind of began to grow up with the good changing environment that was taking place. And we voted this particular African-American, who later became a doctor, went to Duke to med school, and practiced in Columbus till he recently retired. So yes, it's been very important. I think when you look at our company in terms of diversity, I'll put our track record up against anyone. Our president of the U.S. operations was an African female who retired 2 years ago. Now it's an African male who's president of the U.S. My general counsel is an African-American female. My head of IT, my head of public relations is a Hispanic female woman. And the list goes on. And that's something I'm very proud of. And we continue to work. Our board is diverse. Minorities actually make up 60% of the board. So yes, that's important. And it's a good business decision in addition, because we actually have a diverse group that we're selling to in an employer-employee environment. And so to identify, you need salespeople, administrative people that understand that diverse workplace and what's taking place in it.
Yeah, now you said that so well, and Aflac really is exemplary in this space and has been for decades. And you nailed it, Dan. This is, at end of day, about business. You want your business to reflect your customer base and vice versa. And it's just a good idea. And I sure hope, as the DEI conversation more broadly has become such a, you know, a hot touchstone, I hope we get back to remembering that it's just about good. Forget about what's the social justice and the obviously correct things to do. The way I see the world, I think fundamentally, forget about right, left, it comes down to right, wrong. And employing a workforce that looks like your customer base is just an easy right decision. So I hope we get back to that focus, that this is about what's also good for business.
Well, to me, it's a natural thing. And some of my closest friends are African Americans. And it has worked out very well in my business environment. But I have to say this, a lot of people think the responsibility of that happening will be a minority officer that's in charge of diversity, or that the African-American group of people of color or women will push it. It's got to be the responsibility of the CEO to push it. And especially if it is a Caucasian male, if you push it, they don't expect it. They expect it to come from another direction. And when you push it, I always say, look, there's nothing I gain out of this. I'm doing it because it's the right thing and it's a good business decision. And so that's what has to happen, is the people are listening today. It comes from the people that are in the majority. They have to push to make this work. And I am very fortunate that I've got great people that are doing a fabulous job. And I attribute a lot of that to our ability to be diverse.
Yeah, you hit on so many good points there, Dan. And one, which is one that we've talked about time and time again on Great Minds, is this notion of appointing a chief diversity officer, most often, you know, a 40-some-odd black woman. And great press release, big announcement, and very predictably, no budget behind it. Not that much happens. You know, it's more about ticking a box. I remember going to one of the big holding companies, Omnicom, which is one of the big, big players in our industry. And they used to be headquartered on 437 Madison. And going up, I forgot who I was seeing, but it was somebody in the executive floor, which very much looked like a classic law firm, you know, a lot of wood paneling and, you know, not a very creative atmosphere. And there was one woman, Tiffany Warren, who was terrific and later started something called Ad Color, which became very prominent in the industry over time, had an office there as Omnicom's chief diversity officer. And you just felt like somebody decided we need to have, you know, one black person in an office on this floor and let's make that her. And it really just was such, you know, BS. And you nailed it. It's leadership from the top. That's what gets it done.
I think that's right. I do think however you start, you just got to start it. And if you're starting now, you're starting too late. This has been going on for decades, and we got to jump on it and get moving, because if there's anything we're seeing in today's environment is we need people coming together, not separating from each other.
Well, great conversation. We got a lot of ground to cover, but I love that we wove our way into that rich, rich subject. And kudos to you for leading by example. So, Dan, let's talk about another Amos, and that's Paul. You are uniquely the son of a co-founder, a very successful one, and have taken what you started with initially as a salesperson, albeit a very successful one, at a very young age back in 1973. And you have taken this company to stratospheric heights, I'm sure well beyond what your dad imagined. But we'd be remiss as we start to talk about Aflac not to talk about your father, Paul.
Well, I love my dad, and he was a quintessential salesperson to me. And my uncle John, who was the CEO, he died young. He died at 66 from cancer. And so I did take over at 39 years old. So I was young at the time. And my dad was 65 or 66. And he said the transition should be one move and not two. And so I came on as CEO and he stayed as chairman. And he played an important role in giving me guidance and advice over the years. And I'll be forever grateful for that. I think, yes, he would be. My uncle would be looking down, happy, I hope, and certainly my dad would be. And so I feel very fortunate and blessed to be where we are today.
It's an incredible story. And the company that you took the helm of was a $1 billion company, but sort of the bottom, you know, bottom on the chart of billions, if you will. I don't know that such a thing actually exists. I suppose being on any chart with billions is good. But you have built the company up, grown revenue, you know, in double figures. And you're also, Dan, on a lot of good lists. You're on a, you know, best company to work for, most admired company by real authorities, Fortune, and of course, most importantly, and not surprisingly with our conversation here, among the most ethical companies and consistently on that list. Talk about what you got when you took the helm with your dad still as chair and where you've taken it and sort of key milestones on that journey.
Well, we never started out to be on the list, but I have to say, once you get on the list, you don't want to fall off the list. So you tend to then identify and want to know how and what takes place to be on that list. And yes, I think it's important because when you're looking for certain people, especially in today's internet world, they start researching. And when they if a good example is I'm looking for a top-notch minority candidate, they will be impressed that we're one of the 50 best places to work for African Americans. Or on women, we'd be one of the best places to work for working mothers, or whatever the case might be, or Hispanic, where we're on that list. So yeah, I think they're important, and ethical is to me, you shouldn't have awards for ethical in that everybody ought to be ethical. Unfortunately, it's not true, but that everyone is. But you know, it's kind of like having air. You got to have air to breathe. Well, you got to have an ethical company to be in a good position. And anything less than that's just unacceptable. And so I've always felt like that the way you're the most ethical is ultimately opening everything up to where people can look in and see everything happening as much as possible, to where you're transparent in every degree. And it also makes life a whole lot simpler. You know, if you're just transparent, it is what it is. When you're trying to keep a story going, it's much harder than it is to just be open about it. And it's always worked to our advantage, because really and truly, ultimately, people that invest in your company are trusting your company, that you'll fulfill whatever you said you'll do to the best of your ability. And there are times when you can't help it, but they're outside your control possibly, or whatever it might be. But generally, the thing I would say is in my track record, was that we met all of our financial objectives over the last 35 years has been the reason we've grown the way we have.
Just an amazing story, and still booming along. Something I did not know until our crack Great Minds research team handed over their findings to me on a stand, but huge in Japan. Talk about the evolution of Aflac's business in one of my favorite places, the great nation of Japan.
Well, it is a fascinating story. I mean, we were a tiny company at that particular time. It was during 1968 in the Osaka World's Fair. And my uncle, John Amos, who was the CEO, went to the World's Fair and he saw a thriving economy. And he noticed people wearing surgical masks. And back then, he didn't know what that meant, and we didn't know either. You know, compared to today with COVID, we know exactly what it means. But in this particular case, they said to him, well, we wear the surgical mask because it's so crowded, we don't want to pass around the common cold. And so when we get in those crowded trains and things like that, we wear these to stop that. And he went, anybody that'll do that will buy insurance because they're very health conscious. And he said, I want to get licensed there. And we spent over 5 years working on a license and finally became the first company after World War II to get licensed in Japan as an insurance company. And from there, it took off. And we wrote the first year than we wrote the first 7 years. And today it accounts for, depending on where the yen is, but somewhere around 70 to 75% of our company is in Japan.
That's an amazing story. First company to do business in your category since World War II. That's an amazing achievement.
We're very pleased with that. And today we have over 100 offices throughout Japan. But in addition to that, we have several major. Daiichi Life Insurance Company, the largest life insurance company in Japan, sells for us. Our agents sell for us. Japan Post has over 20,000 offices, and they sell for us. And we have somewhere around 90% of all the companies listed on the Tokyo Stock Exchange. So we've been very fortunate, and it continues to grow. And we work hard at that. And I go a lot to Japan. I used to go six times a year. Now I try to go four times a year.
Yeah, I've been lucky enough to get to go there, not nearly as many as you have, but more than average, probably 12 to 15 times for myself in the last few years. And what an extraordinary place it is.
It is.
Yeah, fantastic stuff. All right, so Dan, we're going to jump around if that's all right with you, because there's so many things I want to touch on. But one of the things that also really pops out is your commitment to philanthropy. And I know that you've done a lot in particular with young people who have been challenged by cancer. And we were lucky enough years ago on our stage to have Marlo Thomas, whose father, Danny Thomas, of course, founded St. Jude's in Memphis, one of the great children's hospital. We also spoke to some very prominent folks from CHOP, the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, which is probably the largest in many ways and most impactful, much greater. I think it's interesting. St. Jude's has this iconic brand and it's this wonderful place, full stop. CHOP is actually a much bigger player in the space, but you don't, you know, they just don't build their brand or pay attention to it as much. You have made this part of the DNA of Aflac, your commitment to young people, in particular comforting young people. So I'd love to talk about that journey of philanthropy into helping young people with cancer and how important that is to you and to Aflac.
Well, first of all, when we got licensed in Japan, one of the things that they were interested in is they thought that they had an epidemic of cancer going on, but they didn't. What was actually happening were people were living long enough to get cancer. So we developed a cancer insurance policy and sold it, and it paid X amount a day for every day you're in the hospital. And then it paid, oh, let's just say $5,000 if you died. But if you died of cancer, it paid $50,000. So there we were in the business of selling cancer insurance in the United States and Japan. And what is now called Children's Healthcare of Atlanta made a call on us in Columbus, Georgia, and it's located, of course, in Atlanta. And they wanted $25,000 for us to give. And when I looked through it, it had a naming opportunity for the cancer center. And they wanted $3 million for it. And I said, this was 26 years ago, I believe, 27, I can't remember, but long time ago. And I said, I'm not interested in $25,000, but we may be interested in the $3 million. Would you consider naming a company after it? And they said, well, we never thought of that. We'll name you or we'll name a person. And I said, no, if we're going to give back, this would be very important to us. And so sure enough, they went back and they said, yes, and we did it. And then I did a match with our field force of so much and got it started. And today, the company and our sales organization and employees have given over $170 million to the Aflac Cancer Center and Blood Disorder at Children's Healthcare of Atlanta. Now, because they combined Scottish Rite and Eggleston, it actually is the largest pediatric cancer center in America and rated one of the top seven by U.S. News and World Report. So it's a fabulous place. I always say, if my grandchildren got sick, that's where I'd take them. There are a lot of great places, but this particular one we love. All of our people are connected with it and participate, and it's fun giving back. So instead of just making a profit on insurance, we're returning some of it. And our field force or our sales organization, more than half of the money that's raised, they actually give it out of their commission. And it's really made a difference, and we're thrilled with that, and we're so glad to do it. And it's been narrowing the focus. And that's kind of the way I am in everything I do in business. I don't look at it as a shotgun approach, but more of a rifle approach, whether it be product or countries you're doing business in, or whether it be a philanthropic endeavor. Concentrating on healthcare has been ours, and specifically the Aflac Cancer Center.
Absolutely. A fantastic story, results driven, and a whole lot of heart, Dan, in everything that you're saying. So let's make another jump and talk about the Aflac brand. You have built a tremendous, tremendous brand, working with creative agencies, working with media agencies, navigating the evolution of our media from, you know, an old and traditional one to a digital dominated world, and navigated that absolutely brilliantly. Talk about the relationship that Aflac has had with Madison Avenue as we start to, you know, build a bridge. I want to get to our wonderful moment on Madison Avenue years ago with the Aflac Duck as part of our Madison Avenue Advertising Walk of Fame. But let's talk about your journey as a steward of the Aflac brand.
Well, other than getting licensed in Japan, probably the second biggest thing was our journey of advertising. And then probably next would be the Aflac Cancer Center and all the things we've done there with my special Aflac Duck and things of that nature. but going back to the brand, we spent 10 years trying to advertise and see if we could build our brand. No one knew us. They knew us because we would get payroll deduction slot, say for Starbucks, and the people would enroll, but they didn't necessarily pay as much attention to who the company was, other than it was deducted and handed through a certain company. And I just threw out Starbucks as an example. So we wanted to build brand recognition, and we spent almost 10 years. And in the 10-year period, we had gone from 2% to still under 10%. And I said, I'm not going to live long enough to get it to a brand anybody will know. So at that time, now my wife, she was in charge of advertising and went out and hired this agency called the Kaplan Thaler Agency, which was made up of these two females who were spectacular. And they then put it out to their creative people, and they came back with the idea of the Aflac Duck. And the Aflac Duck forever changed our company. In fact, I would tell you that the brand is probably worth somewhere between $7 and $10 billion. And the reason I came to that number is we spend about $100 million to $125 million on advertising. The big property casualty insurers that you know the names of spend between $1.7 and over $3 billion on advertising. And so if you just take that number and say, okay, they spent $3 billion and they did it for 5 years, then you got $15 billion in it. So I took a low number in between there and said, that's what it's worth. And we protect that brand in every way possible, because you spend a lifetime building a brand and it takes about 2 seconds to lose the brand. And we had that happen in the case of when the tsunami hit Japan. And when that hit, Gilbert Gottfried, who was the voice of the Aflac Duck, decided to make jokes about that particular thing. I don't know if he knew that we had as much business in Japan as we did, but it was not something that should have been done. And how I found out about it is I got a call. This was back before you had the internet to the level you've got now. They would call you and say, I've got to have my story in by 5 o'clock. I need an answer by then. This guy called me, I remember, at 1 o'clock in the afternoon and said, I need it. I said, well, I'll get back with you by five. He said, no. Now you can do it and I can post it right now. And I said, well, can you give me a little time? And he said, no. And I said, well, will you give me 15, 20 minutes? And he said, why? And I said, because if you're telling me the truth on what you said, I got to go get rid of our spokesperson. And sure enough, in that 20 minutes, I called up. The story was valid, and we had to discontinue our relationship with him. And we didn't have a single commercial in the U.S. In Japan, we used a different voice, but in the U.S., and so we pulled everything, and then we found we had one that was a silent movie. And we picked up that, changed the writing in it, got it out within a week or so, and we started looking for the voice of the Aflac Duck. And we then ran that across the country, and I forgot how many thousands of people. I think it was like 12,000 people applied for the position. We then ended up hiring somebody in the Midwest, and they've been the voice of the Aflac Duck ever since.
Well, an amazing, amazing story. And I love the fierce protection of your brand, the decisiveness of a chief executive officer confronted with a set of facts and acting on those facts. There was no committee. There was no mullet over. There was no flip-flopping. It was, this is the situation. And I happen to know Gilbert. We were in the Friars Club together, and Gilbert was a no filter, absolutely filthy, filthy joke teller, really filthy. And it was always interesting to me that he had that role. He was brilliant in it creatively as the voice of the Aflac Duck, giving credit where credit is due. But comedy is a little bit like juggling, juggling fire. And sometimes it goes wrong.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And we hated that happened. But what I will say is when I was thrown into that situation, the problem was, is if I said, I'll give you an answer tomorrow, then the story would have been Aflac is debating what to do. And you never control the situation after that. So I felt like we had to declare which direction we were going and had no choice. And that's what's different in today's world than it was when I first came CEO, is you're not only required to act, but you're required to act quickly without any hesitation or you lose control of the story.
Yeah. No, so well said, Dan. And what phenomenal stories we've covered here. As we start to wrap, I just wonder, you're still at the, Richard, we have to interrupt there. Fuck. I told you and I didn't put my thing on silent. Okay. Sorry. Richard, let's roll back. Dan, as we start to wrap, you've accomplished so much, but you're still very much at the top of your game. Working as hard as ever, Aflac's business continuing to grow. Is there something out there on the horizon looking forward that's on your business bucket list, a place that you want to take Aflac that you haven't been to before? And that could mean almost anything. It's an open-ended question, but what do you see in the future as you look into the Aflac crystal ball the next 3-5 years, give or take?
Well, I tend to be more of a marathon runner than a sprinter. And I love setting objectives and then achieving them. That's the reason I always like sales. You could debate when I was young in the business whether or not I was getting it because of my family or whether or not I got it because of my family and then I could earn it. And I always felt like there was less subjectivity. So my thing has always been, is have steady growth and have a safety net that you don't risk a lot for a little, but you really build the company based on that. I majored in risk management and insurance at the University of Georgia. And the three principles was don't risk a lot for a little, don't risk more than you can afford to lose, and consider the odds. And so every decision I make, I think through that process and how we can do it. And, you know, yes, we look for other countries possibly one day to do business. We look for new products and services that are out there, but we take them on with the confidence that it to protect and then build upon, not to risk a lot. Because we're in the business of having risk or sharing risk, but it's managed and controlled risk. And so I want to see us continue to grow. When I first came in, stock was under $1 a share. And today it's $108 a share or something. But so I've been very fortunate. And I think it's the team of people that I've got, and we want to continue to grow it, but we want to do it in a way that continues to protect the shareholders and grow it at the same time, providing a quality of products and services that people need. And then finally give back to the Aflac Cancer Center to help families in need to hopefully one day they'll find a cure for it.
What a great conversation and way to wrap. I'm so glad you mentioned Kaplan Thaler. Linda was an old friend of ours back when we started Advertising Week 20 years ago. And I remember the campaign. I remember when they then became part of the Publicis family. But what a great conversation, Dan. Thank you so much for doing this. Thanks to my pal Dan Beeson for setting us up. You are really something, young man. I'm sure we'll be in touch.
Thank you very much. I hadn't been called young in a long time. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.